In the previous lecture, we saw how Diocletian managed to breathe new life into the Roman Empire at a time when it might have appeared to be on its last legs. But we saw too that in the West, that only bought it another 100 years or so. In this lecture, we turn our attention to the East, beginning in the reign of Diocletian's successor, Constantine. Due to squabbles over the succession, the Tetrarchy did not survive the abdication of Diocletian and Maximian in 305. This was largely because of the ambitions of Constantine, consequent upon the premature death of his father Constantius I, who had been appointed Augustus in the West. When his father died at York in northern Britain, Constantine was proclaimed emperor by his troops. There followed a period of civil war in the West. This culminated in the Milvian Bridge, just north of Rome in 312, where he defeated Maxentius, son of the former Tetrarch Maximian. Before the battle, he had his soldiers paint crosses on their shields. After his victory, Constantine was hailed by the Senate as liberator and officially became emperor of the West. The consequences resulting from Constantine's victory were momentous. He had been heavily outnumbered by Maxentius, some scholars estimate by as much as 5 to 1. And soon after, he claimed that he had had a vision or a dream. There are several versions. Initially, he said it was a vision of Apollo, accompanied by the Roman numerals XXX, signifying that his reign would last for 30 years. Then, towards the end of his life, he claimed he had seen a single X, signifying the Christian cross, accompanied by the words In hoc signo vinces, in this sign you will conquer. In 313, Constantine and the Eastern Emperor Licinius recognized each other as the two legitimate Augusti and promulgated the policy of religious freedom that we talked of before, the so-called Edict of Milan. Whether Constantine was himself a practicing Christian is one of the big unknowns in history. Most of his public actions could be said to have been dictated by pragmatism. What's undeniable is that he was an autocrat who sought to present himself to his subjects as a man of profound piety, which is how he is depicted in the biography by a Christian writer called Eusebius of Caesarea. We see this in the autocratic air in his portraits. His features express a kind of otherworldliness, almost a godliness. A good example is the giant marble head from a seated statue that was once placed in the Basilica Nova in the Roman Forum. Especially noteworthy are the large, haunting eyes, which convey this sense of otherworldliness. We may note, too, that within a few years of the Battle of the Milvian Bridge, the gods disappear from the coinage and from other artwork. Some historians think that what induced Constantine to Christianize the empire was the hierarchical structure of the church, which provided a kind of absolutist model that he wanted to encourage on the temporal plane for his own benefit. Constantine wasn't christened till he was on his deathbed, though we shouldn't read too much into that, since it was commonplace for Christians of this era to wait until they reached their last days. Even so, to what extent Constantine was a devout Christian, and to what extent he was merely a tolerant pagan, is one of the great conundrums of history. As Raymond Davis notes in this context, sincerity is not determinable by historical method. As a result of the Edict of Milan, Constantine began funding Christian churches. In addition, Christians began to secure positions in administrative and social circles that had been denied them under the pagan emperors. As a result, a great number of people converted to Christianity, both out of self-interest as well as for spiritual ends, beginning perhaps with Constantine himself. Indeed, the fact that the Edict of Toleration went much further than merely accommodating Christianity when it was put into effect may well be due in large part to the fact that Constantine saw Christianity as a way to promote his own interests by exploiting his image as Christ's representative on earth. Even so, it would be wrong to think that the entire population became Christianized as a result of the edict. As we've seen, polytheism continued to remain a vital force in many parts of the Roman Empire for at least 100 years. In fact, some scholars believe that even by the year 400, over 50% of the population was still pagan. Relations between Constantine and the Eastern Emperor Licinius were strained, and in 316, they broke out into open conflict. In 324, Constantine won a resounding victory and became sole emperor, with the result that the two halves of the empire were reunited. Soon afterwards, he dedicated a new city on the European shore of the Bosporus, on the site of Byzantium, a city founded in the 7th century BC, and on the site of modern-day Istanbul. It's worth pausing to ask why he took this momentous decision. It wasn't as if Rome had ceased to have any importance. After his victory over Maxentius, the Senate had erected the famous triumphal arch there in his honour, one of the most splendid examples of late antique architecture. He, in turn, had provided Rome with magnificent baths and with the so-called Basilica Nova, or New Basilica, one of the largest basilicas ever built overlooking the Roman Forum. And he also began work on St. Peter's. But none of the Tetrarchs had ruled from Rome, so Constantine was in effect following in their tradition. In fact, Diocletian had previously used Nicomedia, a modern Izmit in Turkey, as his headquarters, so as more readily to be able to defend the eastern and Danubian frontiers. So Constantine was, in a sense, merely moving his headquarters down the road from the eastern side of the Bosporus to the European side of the Bosporus. Constantine named his city Constantinopolis, Constantinople as we call it, meaning the city of Constantine. It did not immediately replace Rome as the capital of the Roman Empire. In fact, Constantine spent most of his life in the West. It did later, however, and by around 500, it numbered at least 500,000, possibly even 1,000,000. And it remained the capital of the Byzantine Empire for over 1,000 years when Constantine XI fell fighting the Ottoman Turks on the city walls in 1453. The choice of site for the new city had something to do with the fact that, like Rome, it possessed seven hills. Constantine was fully aware of the need to acknowledge in symbolic terms the historic ties between East and West. And since, too, there were already signs that the empire was splitting into two halves. Another site that he had considered was ancient Ilion, or Troy. Ilion had, of course, very important symbolic associations for both the Greeks and the Romans, since Rome had been founded by refugees from Troy, and the Trojan War was a great marking place for the ancient Greeks, the greatest war they ever fought. Constantinople was built in double quick time. The old city of Byzantium was demolished, and a wall was built across the peninsula from the Golden Horn to the Sea of Marmora. What made Constantinople unique among all the cities in the empire was that it was planned from the start primarily as a Christian city. I say primarily because it seems it may have had, among other things, a cult of Tuke, or fortune. And it was also alleged that pagan rites were secretly performed during the consecration of the city. A document dating to the 5th century, known as the Notitia, or survey, listed 14 Christian churches. Incidentally, the same document informs us that there were 11 palaces, 8 public baths, 322 streets, and 4,388 houses. And that's not including apartment blocks, which gives us some sense of its size. And it also included a magnificent hippodrome. In a variety of ways, Constantinople took Rome as its model. The official name of the new city was Constantinopolis Ner Rome, the city of Constantine, New Rome. Its constitution was based on the Roman model with a Senate and annually elected magistrates. Like Rome, it was divided into 14 administrative regions. Constantine was keen to preserve a sense of unity, despite the fact that the empire's capital had moved across the Mediterranean, or would do. Latin was the official language of his court, and Greeks were required to learn Latin in order to pursue careers in law. At the same time, he encouraged a revival in the study of Greek literature. And when in 325 a university was founded, he endowed 10 chairs in Greek grammar and an equal number in Latin. There were also 5 chairs in Greek rhetoric and 3 in Latin, as well as 2 for law and 1 for philosophy. Constantinople could not have been founded without a sizable shift of resources and population. And as such, it represents one of the most ambitious architectural enterprises ever undertaken. To begin with, a large number of pagan art treasures were brought from Greece to adorn the new capital, including the tripod of Apollo from Delphi. I say art treasures because they were not regarded as sacred objects, but objects that would bring aesthetic pleasure. There was even a bit of old Athens there as well, in the form of the statue of Athena Promachus, Athena who fights in the front rank, which was removed from the Acropolis and set up in the city. The statue was 36 feet high, and it's said that the tip of the spear which Athena held in her right hand had been visible, glinting in the sunlight to sailors on ships as they rounded Cape Sunion, some 30 miles away. More significantly, perhaps, a large number of people had to be forcibly resettled in the city from all around the area to swell its size. In the words of Norman Davis, Constantinople's neighbours were vandalised, emptied, and starved. Henceforth, ships laden with grain from Egypt, Syria, and Asia were redirected from the west to Constantinople to feed its burgeoning population. The centre of gravity in the Mediterranean basin had now shifted significantly from the heartland of Italy to the Balkans and points further east. The Byzantine Empire was, on the whole, a success story, largely because Constantinople was a highly effective capital city. It derived enormous wealth from trade, it was extremely well defended, its walls were some 13 miles in length, and it had an efficient bureaucracy that organized the armies and the economy. Thanks to the Edict of Milan, Christianity now began to gain ground throughout the empire, though not unopposed. It actually faced its toughest challenge from the Emperor Julian, known by his Christian detractors as Julian the Apostate, who ruled from 361 to 363. Julian was the nephew of Constantine. Although he'd been brought up as a Christian, he secretly converted to paganism in his youth. He was Caesar in the western half of the empire and proclaimed emperor by his troops in 360. And in 361, became emperor of both the eastern and western halves of the empire. As soon as he became sole emperor, Julian publicly denounced Christianity, and to demonstrate that he was in earnest, he performed animal sacrifices to the gods as a thanksgiving. He dressed in the guise of a Greek philosopher and undertook an ambitious program of reform designed to promote paganism. He also tried to reform the ethical teaching of paganism, in part by leading an exemplary life himself. He didn't actually outlaw Christianity, with the exception of a few officers who refused to remove the image of the cross from their shields, whom he had executed. But he did withdraw legal and financial privileges that had been accorded to the Christian Church by previous emperors. In addition, he decreed that Christians should no longer be permitted to teach Greek literature. The right to teach Greek literature, especially Greek philosophy, was to become central in paganism's attempt to withstand the advance of Christianity. Greek literature was still central to the curriculum, and by prohibiting Christians from teaching it, Julian hoped, in effect, to ban them from teaching altogether. Julian should not be dismissed as an irrelevant crackpot, as someone who just didn't get what was going on. He was, for a start, highly educated. He wrote learned philosophical treatises in defense of paganism and attacking its opponents, notably a treatise entitled Against the Galileans. And he was sincerely committed to the belief that the ethical values of paganism were on a par with, if not superior to, Christianity. There's another important point to grasp. It's through the events of Julian's brief reign that we can best detect some of the tensions that were running through classical culture at this point. The tensions were largely due to the Greeks, highly educated Greeks, who busied themselves with their books and their lectures instead of involving themselves in the affairs of state. And many of them didn't know Latin and didn't care to know it either. It was the old story repeating itself in a new form, a kind of Greek intellectual snobbery that had dogged Greco-Roman relations for centuries. Julian sought to draw these intellectuals into his government and bring about a revival of Hellenic culture at the highest level of Roman politics. And how better to do this than by reviving pagan belief? His experiment failed, partly because of the brevity of his reign. He died in mysterious circumstances after having launched an attack on the Persian Empire, and partly because he had a rather romanticized view of paganism, and partly because there was no popular support for his policy. But had he lived, it's fair to say that Christianity would have had to defend itself much more vigorously against the forces of Hellenism than it did. His untimely death is another of those accidents that deflected the course of history in a particular way. Theodosius I, who reigned from 379 to 395, dismantled his pro-pagan program. Sacrifice was forbidden, temples were closed, pagan practices of every sort were forbidden, and pagan religion was virtually outlawed. From now on, the church was committed to a policy of coercion. So, why had Christianity triumphed? That's a hugely difficult question to answer, and one that would occupy several lectures on its own. It was the result of what was arguably the most profound change in human thinking in the West at any time in history. To quote Philippe Rousseau, what had happened was that the controlling element in a whole society had changed its mind about the meaning of history and experience. That's an interesting observation, but you'll note he doesn't even mention religion. And that's because the changeover to Christianity was far more profound than merely a transformation in religious belief. It had to do with perceptions of society, social hierarchy, authority, charity, economics, ideology, and so on. It represented a massive upheaval in the way in which individuals saw their place in the Mediterranean world. Theodosius was the last emperor to rule both East and West, and when he died in 395, he bequeathed the empire to his two sons. His elder son, Arcadius, ruled from Constantinople, and his younger son, Honorius, ruled from Milan. From Milan, note, not from Rome. Arcadius's son, Theodosius II, then became the first Roman emperor both to be born in Constantinople and to rule there throughout his reign. His was, moreover, a very long reign, from 408 to 450, long enough to make his favouring of Constantinople an unalterable fact of political life. Longevity often plays a very important part in the shaping of historical events. It did in the reign of Augustus. So, the division of the empire into two halves, which came about in 395, was not planned. One might even say that it came about in part, at least by accident, on the grounds that it was a political convenience that honoured the aspirations of two sons. But because it made sense on grounds of logic, it legitimated what was already a fact of life, and it proved permanent. Historians talk from this point onwards of the Byzantine Empire in deference to the importance of Constantinople. But there's no actual consensus as to when the Byzantine period actually begins. Some place it in the reign of Diocletian, since he was the first to divide the empire for administrative purposes into a pars orientis, eastern half, and a pars occidentis, a western part. Others place it a generation or two later in the reign of Theodosius I, but it's really Constantine, I think, who deserves the title First Byzantine Emperor. Despite the division, the subjects of the Byzantine Empire continued to identify themselves as Romans, which suggests that the values for which the empire stood, security, stability, and a tradition of Greco-Roman learning, were still in place, at least as an ideal, notwithstanding the influx of barbarians. The Byzantine Empire presents us, in fact, with something of a paradox. The peoples living within its borders were, of course, predominantly Greek, and the language they spoke was Greek. But they didn't call themselves Hellenes, the Greek word for Greeks. Instead, they called themselves Romaioi, Romans, which tells us a great deal about how they saw themselves. The designation Romaioi actually existed among rural Greeks well into the 20th century. They used it as a badge of pride to denote that they were pure Greek. Greeks, in other words, whose blood had not been diluted or tainted, as they would say, by intermarriage with the Ottoman Turks, who had ruled Greece during what they call the Turkokratia, the period of Turkish rule that lasted from 1453 to 1821. And similarly, the Byzantine Empire was referred to officially as He Basileia ton Romaion, the Empire of the Romans. Another important feature to grasp is that there was now no distinction between church and state. Church and state comprised a single, indivisible entity, and it was the emperor's role to attend both to the physical and to the spiritual welfare of his subjects. There was, however, a pagan precedent for this. Emperors from Augustus onwards had assumed the role of Pontifex Maximus, or chief pontiff. But it's probably fair to state that the emperor's religious role was now very much more to the fore. The rule and authority of the emperor on earth now came to parallel the rule and authority of God in heaven. The emperor was the living embodiment of Christ and also God's vice-regent on earth, as reflected in the way in which portraits of the emperor and those of Christ Pantocrator, Christ all-powerful, closely resembled one another. Now let's turn our attention to what was happening in the East in the 4th and 5th centuries. Both militarily and economically, the East was in much better shape than the West, though it wasn't without its own economic and military problems. The fact that it ultimately survived, whereas the Western half didn't, was due to a number of factors. Number one, it had a much larger population. In fact, it's estimated that by the late 3rd century AD, approximately 70% of the empire's total population lived in the East. Incidentally, the empire's total population in the late 3rd century is put at a conservative estimate at around 70 million. Number two, it was more prosperous than the West. Number three, it had a better army and a better navy than the West. And number four, it had a shorter frontier to patrol than the West. Whereas the frontier of the Western Empire consisted of the Rhine and the Upper Danube, the Eastern Empire had only to guard the Lower Danube and its border with Persia. As we saw at the end of the previous lecture, in 476, a barbarian by the name of Odoacer had taken control of Italy. He ran it from his court at Ravenna. And when he was assassinated, the Ostrogoths had continued to do so as well, more or less independent of the East. The nostalgic vision of the once all-powerful, all-embracing Roman Empire nonetheless continued to mesmerize the imagination. And when Justinian succeeded to the Byzantine throne in 527, he made it his objective to recover at least part of the Western Empire. We don't know how far Justinian's ambitions extended. Did he seriously think he could reverse the course of history? That seems highly unlikely. Perhaps, like so many leaders before and since, he was using war as a distraction from the troubles he was facing back home. In 532, he had been all but deposed in the so-called Nika riot. The Nika riot was named after Nika, victory, the rallying cry of the rival supporters of the chariot teams which competed in the Hippodrome in Constantinople. Riots among chariot team hooligans were not uncommon, but on this occasion, the two main rival groups, the Blues and the Greens, so named for the racing colours of the teams they supported, joined forces in protesting against the emperor. Justinian used disproportionate force to crush the uprising. It said that some 30,000 insurgents perished. Subsequently, it may well have seemed prudent to Justinian and to his savvy wife, Theodora, to direct attention away from domestic problems by embarking on a foreign war. Well, whatever his motivation, we need hardly doubt that his campaign held a nostalgic appeal for his people. After Justinian had made peace with Persia in 532 in order to secure his eastern flank, his general Belisarius recovered North Africa from the Vandals in 534. And the following year, Belisarius invaded Italy, claiming to be the avenger of a murdered Ostrogothic queen called Amalasuntha, who had been supportive of the Byzantines. It took Justinian's forces nearly 20 years to retake Italy after a long and bloody struggle. Not only did this struggle wreak havoc on Italy, but it also put serious strains on the resources of the Byzantine Empire. Justinian died in 565. He's lucky that he survived an outbreak of bubonic plague, Justinian's plague as it's called, which arrived in Constantinople in 542, carried by the Mediterranean black rat. The pandemic is thought to have killed 25 million, roughly a third of the entire population. On the cultural side, Justinian's achievement was also mixed. He was responsible in the years 532 to 37 for the reconstruction of the Church of Hagia Sophia, the Church of Holy Wisdom, in Constantinople. This is one of the greatest architectural marvels in the world and was the biggest church in the world at the time. He also masterminded the Corpus Iuris Civilis, the Code of Civil Law, a recodification of Roman law, which brought order out of chaos and which is a foundational document of legal theory. But on the negative side, he also forbade the teaching of philosophy in Athens, thereby ending a tradition of philosophical inquiry that had begun with the establishment of Plato's Academy over 1,000 years before. Justinian's military legacy was soon consigned to oblivion. 3 years after his death, in 568, a Germanic tribe known as the Lombards swept down into Italy and captured pretty much all the territory that he had taken from the Ostrogoths. And meanwhile, back in his own heartland, the Byzantine Empire went onto the defensive as a new aggressor, the Slavs, broke through its Danube border. Even 568 was not the final parting of the ways between the Greeks and the Romans, since Byzantine emperors retained a presence in Italy and continued to play a part in its affairs. Ravenna, which had been captured by Justinian's general Belisarius in 540, became the capital of the territories that the Byzantine Empire ruled in Italy. It was thus the seat of what was known as the Imperial Exarchate. Exarchate means rule from afar. The best piece of evidence for the presence of the Byzantines in the city in this era is the Church of San Vitale, whose glorious mosaics, which are among the finest in existence, include depictions of Justinian and his wife, Theodora. The church, by the way, which is domed, shows the influence of the Pantheon in Rome. Ravenna also became the centre of resistance to the Lombards. The exarch, the ruler of the province of Ravenna, was the representative of the emperor whose court remained at Constantinople. Of the many consequences resulting from the split between East and West, I'm going to mention just two. First, it would eventually lead to a profound division in Christianity, the so-called Great Schism of the 11th century, which resulted in the establishment of Roman Catholicism, centered in Rome, in the West, and in the establishment of Orthodoxy, based in Byzantium, in the East. Second, it caused the demise of Greco-Roman bilingualism. Mainly because of doctrinal differences, relations between the Latins and the Byzantines became increasingly strained from the 7th century onwards. In 727, a bitter struggle broke out between the Patriarch of Constantinople and the Pope in Rome over iconoclastic reforms. The last exarch was killed by the Lombards in 751. Byzantium held one last toehold in Sicily until the Arab conquest in the 9th century. Knowledge of Greek disappeared from Spain, Britain, Ireland, Gaul and Africa in the 6th century. And in the 7th century, there was hardly anyone in Italy, even in Ravenna, who was sufficiently competent in Greek to correspond with the court in Constantinople. Sicily became the last bastion of Greek in the West, a reflection of the fact that the eastern part of the island had originally been settled by Greeks. When the Arabs conquered Sicily in the 9th century, most Greek-speaking Sicilians migrated to southern Italy. From this point onwards, knowledge of Greek was confined to the monasteries of southern Italy. A similar situation took place in the east. Latin was no longer spoken in Constantinople. The Nadir, as a result of the rift between east and west, was the Fourth Crusade, which in 1204 led to the sack of Constantinople. To conclude, the eastern half of the empire survived the dissolution of the west by over 1,000 years, even though the territorial ambitions of Justinian very nearly brought it to its knees. Greeks and Romans now largely went their separate ways, though there is not a little irony in the fact that it was the Byzantine Greeks who saw themselves as true Romans. In the final lecture, we're going to investigate some of the ways in which the Greeks and the Romans continue to exist to this day as both distinctive and yet inseparable entities.